I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There is a reason why we know more about the founding fathers of America than the founding mothers. The very word history, which is presumably a straightforward accounting of what we need to know about what went before us, can be neatly broken down into his story, not hers. Even though the often overlooked story of Anne Hutchinson's remarkable life is certainly worth knowing. A passionate defender of her Puritan faith, Hutchinson's unconventional ideas ran afoul of the male judges of the Massachusetts General Court in 1637. Banished from her home community, she went on to co-found the colony of Rhode Island, even as her detractors established Harvard College to educate others who would enforce their worldview. 13 generations later, one of Hutchinson's descendants has written a riveting account of a woman who would not be silenced and who deserves her place as one of America's founding mothers. We invite you to join the conversation as we reflect this hour on Hutchinson's life. How much do you know about the life and times of this 17th century midwife and revolutionary? If Anne had been Andrew, would we know her story better? And why were her ideas so threatening that she had to be banished? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're joined in our Boston studio now by Eve LaPlante, author of American Jezebel, The Woman Who Defied the Puritans, and who is herself a direct descendant of Anne Hutchinson. Welcome.
It's my pleasure, Gail.
What did you really know about her growing up? What that meant to be her descendant?
Well, when I was a girl, I had a great aunt on Cape Cod who kept family trees and was very interested in all the ancestors that she could find. And Anne Hutchinson was one of the names that she often mentioned to me as being somebody we should be very proud of being descended from. And I knew the basic story that Anne had come to Boston in 1634, or I didn't know the date then, but and that she had been banished and gone off to Rhode Island and then ultimately to New York, where she died. There was always a slight odd feeling about it that this was a very ferocious person, and I couldn't exactly say that as a girl I was proud of this ancestor. I found the story slightly intimidating, and perhaps I had internalized the cultural suspicion of women with public power, even though my great aunt Charlotte was very proud of this figure. There was something about it I was a little embarrassed about. And in high school, when I learned about Anne Hutchinson in American history class, I had the same feeling. I raised my hand and I told my teacher that I was a descendant of hers, and then I immediately blushed, thinking, oh, what will he think of me? It was only as a middle-aged person looking back on this life, which is in many ways so much like our own today, that I gained a real appreciation and understanding of what Anne Hutchinson was doing.
And who are some of her other really famous descendants?
Well, Franklin Roosevelt was an eighth great-grandson of hers, and George Bush Sr. was a ninth great-grandson, and therefore President Bush is a tenth great-grandson of Anne Hutchinson's.
There is a statue of her outside the Massachusetts State House in Boston that shows this very pious woman who appears to be in prayer. She has a child at her side. She's not exactly a Jezebel, as your title suggests. And so perhaps we could start by reminding us of who Jezebel was and why this term would be applied to her.
Jezebel was an ancient Israeli queen, 8 centuries before Christ, who was married to King Ahab, king of Israel. And she is generally viewed historically in Christian faith as the most evil woman in the Bible. She's described in the books of Kings in the Old Testament. And what she basically, the only thing she really did was to worship the wrong God as viewed by the writers of the Old Testament, because she didn't worship the Jewish God. She worshiped Baal, the Canaanite gods. And she was in a battle with Elijah, the prophet Elijah, and they were both quite murderous and intent on removing the other, and he won. And then the Old Testament was written by the winners. If you read the what little mentions there are several mentions of her in the books of Kings. She really is simply just a powerful woman. And the reason she's called American Jezebel is that John Winthrop, the first governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, after he had succeeded in removing her from Massachusetts because she was such a threat, he wrote a sort of a description of what he had done to send back to England so that he would make sure that politically he would have support there from the king. And he referred to her as this American Jezebel, which was a code word for this most evil satanic influence. The reason that we were able to use this wonderful title was we could sort of turn it on its head and imagine that we have information about Anne Hutchinson because she left trial transcripts, and we have no way of knowing what the original Jezebel would have said or thought if she could have had anything left for posterity, say letters or transcripts. So to call someone a Jezebel is simply to slur them.
Exactly. Set the scene for us. Page one of your book. I wonder if you'd start with a little reading to give us a sense about how that trial looked as it began in this little meeting house in Cambridge in November of 1637.
Yes. This is the opening of her first of two trials. We are in Cambridge in Harvard Square, in this timber and clay mud structure, which was the courthouse, the church, and also the community hall. And this is near the opening of the book. There was nothing auspicious about Anne Hutchinson's appearance as she stood in the doorway alongside several male relatives and supporters awaiting the start of her trial. She was 46 years old, of average height and bearing, with an unremarkable face. Her petticoat fell almost to the ground, revealing only the tips of her leather boots. Against the cold, she wore a wool cloak. A white coif covered her hair, as was the custom. Besides that, and her white linen smock and neckerchief, she wore all black. She was a stranger to no one present, having ministered as midwife and nurse to many of their wives and children. All knew her to be an active member of the Church of Boston, the wife of the wealthy textile merchant William Hutchinson, the mother of 12 living children, and the grandmother of one, a 5-day-old boy who just that Sunday had been baptized. There was, in short, no outer sign to suggest she was an enemy of the state. Enemy she was, though, indeed the greatest threat Massachusetts had ever known. More than a few men in the room, including several of the ministers, considered her a witch. Others believed the devil had taken over her soul. The governor, John Winthrop, who was waiting in an antechamber of the meeting house to begin the trial over which he would preside, suspected her of using her devilish powers to subjugate men by establishing the community of women to foster their abominable wickedness.
So, okay, what made them so wicked? Why was she viewed as a criminal?
I think simply because she was a woman, she was called and gifted to teach in public, to have women and ultimately in Boston, men, including the most powerful men, including the governor that defeated John Winthrop in 1636, come and listen to her teach. And she was basically a theologian and functioning as a preacher, although she wasn't really allowed. And the fact that she was a woman simply did not work for them.
It does seem so ironic, doesn't it, that here are the Puritans who have themselves fled religious persecution in the old world. They come to the new one, and what do? They start persecuting one of their own, and over what sounds to us in the modern world as these very narrow doctrinal points of Scripture.
Yeah, the doctrinal issues do at times seem rather arcane, but I think one has to remember that to all of these people, Anne Hutchinson and John Winthrop, who removed her, the Bible was the center of their world. They were trying to create a world based on the Bible. And it was called the Bible Commonwealth. And they believed that they were the inheritors of the original Jews that God had chosen. And this was going to be a new Israel, a new Jerusalem. And I think John Winthrop and many of the early founders, the men who founded the colony, felt that in order to maintain it, they had to remove any potentially dangerous influence, and which could be anything from the Native Indians to women with power to anybody who had an unconventional theology. So you're right. They came here because they were going to be imprisoned or lose their jobs in England because they were reformers, and yet they immediately created a whole set of new people who were unorthodox and needed here to be removed. It's somewhat ironic.
Would she have met with the same fate if she had been Andrew?
I don't think so. If she was very gifted, she was brilliant and charismatic. Had she been a man, I believe that she would have been a minister, most likely. And one of her major allies, who's I think the most interesting character in this book next to Anne, is Reverend John Cotton, who's the most influential minister in early Boston. And he was preaching all the theology she was preaching, and was able to avoid trial, punishment, imprisonment, and in fact remain until his death in 1652 the most noted man of faith in the colony. And he did it by adapting slightly, but it was he who was giving her all her unorthodox ideas.
We want to go to our phone lines now and hear from one of our listeners from Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Carol's on the line. Hi, Carol. Welcome.
Hi. I'm very excited about hearing this program today because I grew up in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, and I went to the Anne Hutchinson Elementary School in the 50s. And coming out of the 50s, I was a 1960s feminist, and Anne Hutchinson was always my identification. She was my heroine. When the town gave it over, the building over for a senior center, I was ready to go to the town council meeting to insist that the building be named the Anne Hutchinson Building.
And was it?
And it was named that, and I didn't need to go. But.
Well, the people of Portsmouth, Rhode Island, are particularly knowledgeable about Anne Hutchinson. That was
right.
The town she settled. When she was
right.
Banished, she walked to Rhode Island and became the founder of that area, Aquidneck, which is Rhode Island. So people down there are extremely well-informed.
What about your neighbors, Carol? Are they as well-informed as you are?
Well, my neighbors across the street are two elderly sisters that have been here for 80 years, and they most certainly are as well-informed. Yeah. I think probably the people moving into town haven't a notion of an idea of who Anne Hutchinson is, but if they ever run into me and I have the opportunity to tell them, I tell them.
You'll tell them.
When I go down to Connecticut to visit my daughter, she lives off the Merritt, I tell people down there, I ask them, do you know the Hutchinson River Parkway, who it was named after?
Oh.
So she and Abraham Lincoln, they were a heroine and my hero and still are. I read a wonderful biography of Anne Hutchinson about 15 years ago, and I never... I didn't write down the title of the author, but it was an excellent, excellent biography. A little dry, but I learned a lot.
Well, you'd probably enjoy this one too, Carol, and we thank you for the call.
Thank you very much for writing it and for the program.
Thank you.
Why do you think she isn't so well known outside Rhode Island? Why is this a story that merits maybe a line in the American history books?
Well, I think it has merited a line. There's no history of America that doesn't have a mention, usually just a partial sentence, of Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson together as the rebels who were early outcasts, who then went on, both of them, to make major contributions to our modern notions of individual liberty and freedom of religion.
All right, we'll pick up on that point when we come back after we take a brief break. We're speaking this hour with Eve LaPlante, author of American Jezebel, The Uncommon Life of Anne Hutchinson, the Woman Who Defied the Puritans. Listeners, is this the first you've heard about the woman who co-founded the colony of Rhode Island? How deeply have you dug into the history books to find the her story that goes with his story? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And this hour, we're continuing our conversation about American Jezebel, the history of a 17th century preacher and midwife who was persecuted for challenging the Puritan conventions of her time. My guest is Eve LaPlante, journalist and author of American Jezebel, which, of course, is the story of Anne Hutchinson. I want to ask about how you described her earlier as ferocious, and I thought that really was a good description. But you have to wonder, how was she able to deal with her trial? Because, again, this was a time when women didn't vote, didn't hold public office, really did not have a big public place in the community. In effect, they were invisible. So this must have been a huge event, not just for her, but for the whole community. And be interested in hearing your thoughts on that, and also whether there are any parallels that you see to her story today.
Yeah, well, I think that, when you think about what she was up against, I mean, it seems clear, historians agree, that she had no she had no alternative to either conforming, and that is being silent in Massachusetts Bay Colony, or to being banished, to leaving, and that the court was going to find a reason to remove her, even if they couldn't, they couldn't find a real crime, they were going to make one up, and they basically did. But you see her up against both the public trial, the civil trial, and then the church trial, and you wonder, as you read American Jezebel, why she didn't back down, because she could have backed down and she could have been silenced. I think it appears from her life story that she had this tremendous call to preach, to explain Scripture to people, and the fact,
as her father had, and he had been jailed as well.
Yes, he was jailed in England, but as a man and a vicar, he was able over the years to conform and adapt himself, and then was given a position in London. So as a teenager, Anne Hutchinson lived in London, which I think was a formative experience for her. This was now early in the 17th century, in the reign of James I, and she was very inspired by her father, and I think she basically felt the same call that he felt, and she had to do this. And you do, on occasion, as you read, wonder why, with all these tiny little children, the scene in the courtroom in Cambridge, Massachusetts, she's nursing her youngest. Her oldest is 21. She's got 15 children. She's pregnant with her 16th. She's 46 years old. She's not feeling well. It turns out to be an abnormal pregnancy, which is associated with a lot of discomfort and very unpleasant. And, you know, and she's walking from Boston to Cambridge and back and then walking to Rhode Island. I mean, it puts in perspective a lot of the stress and troubles that we modern women face. But it's also sort of a mirror for our modern conflict between how you merge work and life as a woman and home life, and how you have a public voice, which there are still certain prescriptions against in modern American life.
There is such a dramatic scene as you tell it. You can just imagine the gasps that must have run through the room when essentially she could have gotten out of the charges against her when suddenly she basically said, in essence, okay, you want to know what I think? Well, listen up. Here it is. If you can just give us the scene, that's okay. It doesn't have to be a reading. I'm just curious about that, the drama of that moment. Why do you think she chose to make her case? She didn't have to.
Well, I think the chief simply would not back down. And at the end, what she tells Governor John Winthrop as she's leaving the church, both the ministers and the judges have all banished her in their two trials. And she turns to John Winthrop and she says, "The Lord judges not as man judges. Better to be cast out of the church than to deny Christ." And you see this throughout her life, through until her death, this very fervent belief and faith that she must stick to her guns. And I think if you find this trait in a man, George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or any of these great founding fathers or male leaders, you tend to admire it. But culturally, there's a certain suspicion of the same grit and determination in a woman. I think we lack for founding mothers. And I think women like Anne Hutchinson need to be brought in and discussed by children in schools and discussed widely among women. She's certainly a model for me.
To Northborough, Massachusetts, we want to hear from Bill. Hello, Bill, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I'd like to correct some of the comments that were made earlier. Anne Hutchinson was not tried and banished because she was a woman or even a forceful woman or even a forceful woman who could think for herself. I mean, she was all of these things. She was quite an interesting individual. But, and this is the part that's very important and hasn't been brought up yet, she challenged the theocratic authority, and let me start by emphasizing that the theocratic authority in Massachusetts was also the temporal authority in Massachusetts. And what she had said, among other things, was that the average citizen did not necessarily owe obedience to the temporal / theocratic authority of the colony at that particular time. Now, you may agree with the government set up at that time, may disagree with it, but that is quite a challenge. And living in those times, you can't, if you are in authority and you are running a government and you are running a colony, you can't overlook either a man or a woman who is preaching that sort of thing. It does smack to some degree of treason.
All right,
that's
Bill.
Number one.
Appreciate the point. Well, let's go with number one because it's an interesting question. You know, was this about gender, or was it about politics, or was it about religion, or, as you say, maybe some mixture of all three?
Bill is absolutely right that she was challenging the authority of the ministers in a way that to us today would seem quite ordinary, that you could have a conversation with a minister and say, well, I disagree with your interpretation of that Bible reading. And her main criticism was that she felt the ministers were preaching what she called a covenant of works. That is, that she said that they're telling people that you can tell whether somebody is saved by God by the external appearance, by their good works, whether they go to church, whether they follow the rules. And this is, it's simply not good theology. It's not good Calvinism. And indeed, we now, everybody would agree that all these ministers were preaching this heresy to the early colonists because it was an easier way to control the populace. But she believed that we could sense internally grace, God's grace, and indeed don't need a minister to appreciate grace. And no one else can look at us and tell whether we have it based on whether we perform good works. She was actually more true to John Calvin, to whom the Puritans all subscribed, than any of the ministers. And she was simply brazen enough to point it out, which today would really not be a very extraordinary thing.
Well, and also one of the reasons why she got into trouble was that she said that, or she was accused of saying, help me figure out which it was, that she could tell if someone was of the elect or not, if someone was saved.
Well, that has always been, that as when I was growing up as a teenager, that's what I read of her, and I found that very, very frightening, as if she were able to determine who was elect or not. Reading all the material I read in writing American Jezebel, I did not find her saying that ever. It is true that John Winthrop in his journal described her saying that. But John Winthrop in his journal was trying to defame her and make himself look good for having removed her in the eyes of the English authorities over the ocean, who had a lot of power over him. I don't think there's clear evidence that she said that. In terms of her theology, she was saying, no, you feel it inside, and no one else can tell you if it's there. She happened to have a very strong feeling of her own salvation. But this was another slur that the ministers and judges use against her to accuse her of saying who else was saved.
So an accusation and not her claim. Let's go to Needham, Massachusetts now. We want to hear from Jeff. Hello, Jeff.
Hi. There's a recent book about John Winthrop by
Francis Bremer.
And his position is basically that, amongst other reasons, that she was forced to leave, as well as people like Roger Williams and many other male ministers, because they were viewed as a political threat, that there were forces in England that would view or describe the Puritans or as having radical religious views, and John Winthrop was trying to prevent England from taking direct political control over the colony.
Well,
so I'm just giving as a devil's advocate that the major reason, or one of the major reasons, was that she was viewed as a political threat to the independence, semi-independence of the colony.
Well, throughout the period that John Winthrop was trying to remove her, the whole controversy between them took about 18 months. The English crown was ordering the colonists, John Winthrop and the other leaders of Massachusetts, to return the charter because they were already very upset about what they felt were questionable things going on in the colony. And John Winthrop and the rest of the court were ignoring this request from the king.
John? Or, sorry, Jeff?
Well, I'm not disagreeing with that, but I'm just saying that there were others who were, such as Roger Williams, who were very liberal and who were you know, forced out, you know, because of their political views. There was a group in England which was viewed John Winthrop as kind of a renegade, and they were trying to basically paint the ministers in religious leaders in the colony as radical.
So you're seeing this more as a political issue than a religious one? Jeff?
Well, I think the religious had impact on the political context, you might say.
Okay.
Well, the two were clearly
merged. That's
the
view of the author of this book.
Yeah, I've read that book. That's an excellent book. And it's interesting to compare Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson, both of whom were banished from Massachusetts for promulgating theology that was not helpful to the leaders of Massachusetts. and they both went off and co-founded Rhode Island. But the interesting comparison is that Reverend Roger Williams continued to maintain a very cordial relationship with John Winthrop, whereas the woman, Anne Hutchinson, who was also, could not be a reverend, was defamed from the time of her removal. And yet the two of them had said somewhat similar things and did somewhat similar things, so they were treated very differently.
Jeff, thanks for the call. What about her position in the larger community? We know that she had these meetings in her home. Women came to them. Sometimes men came to them. Did she have the sympathy of other women, or was she viewed as something of a troublemaker?
Oh, I think she had the sympathy of many, many women. She had very high social status because of her role in the community as a midwife and a nurse, which in that time was perhaps the most powerful woman in the community. She also had a wealthy husband, which helped in many ways. And she, the reason she became such a political threat to John Winthrop was that she not only was closely allied with the most powerful minister in Boston, John Cotton, but she also became allied, I believe inadvertently on her part, with Governor Henry Vane, who was this young newcomer from England who became governor in 1636. So she would have at one hand the reverend and one hand the governor, and effectively was wielding political power. And it was really too much for John Winthrop to stand.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're going now to Columbia, South Carolina. We want to hear from Eldon. Hello, Eldon.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I just thought your listeners would like to hear from an 11th generation descendant of Anne Hutchinson, and how much her descendants, of which there are quite a few that we've been able to locate, have managed to keep her spirit of independence alive over the generations.
Did you grow up knowing about her, Eldon?
Yeah. My mother raised three boys who she was always fond of telling us that we were descendants of Anne Hutchinson, although she couldn't really prove it. It was only a supposition at that time, based on family names and so forth. But she stopped the generational search when she got into the DAR, and after that point, it sort of got foggy. But recently, we've been able to trace the connection.
And do you feel an obligation to be as ferocious as Anne Hutchinson was?
Well, I've got her up on my website, the University of South Carolina, as somebody to model. I put her in a book that I've written about political dissent and rebellion as a early model of American free thinking, and the price she had to pay for that.
It's interesting you say that you've been able to research now your background. It's remarkable what you can find genealogically on the web now, and a lot of people may look and see, and they may find they too are related to Anne Hutchinson, because so much material's on the web, and then the Mormons have a very extensive genealogical library where one wall of the entire library is devoted to Anne Hutchinson's descendants. So it is much easier to research this sort of material than it was even 10 years ago.
All right, Eldon, thank you so much for the call. And in fact, she had, 15 children who survived?
Had 15 children who survived early childhood, which in the 17th century was extraordinary.
Remarkable.
When, you know, many mothers were dying in childbirth, and roughly half of children were dying in childbirth or early childhood. It's a remarkable record, but three of her children died in England, two of the plague, one of unknown causes, six of them died with her at the end of her life when she was massacred in the Bronx, New York.
Hmm. I have to ask what kind of relationship she had with her husband. Obviously, there was this steady stream of children, which tells us something, but was he her intellectual equal? Did he support her in her outspoken behavior?
He was a remarkable husband, I think, even by modern standards. He appears to have been, by all the records, including John Winthrop's journal, a most noted citizen, a good businessman, somebody you could never find any disfavor with. He also happened to have money, which was helpful. When he arrived, like many of the wealthy men, he was granted an island in Boston Harbor and 600 acres of land in Quincy and a large plot in downtown Boston, having been a gentryman in England. He was effectively an aristocrat here. He supported her through everything. He moved from Lincolnshire over to Boston, which was no small feat, then picked up and moved, sailed around Cape Cod, moved to Rhode Island, built a new settlement there with her other male followers. And the only quoted remark that he has, that we have of his, is that when some men from Boston came after her banishment to Rhode Island to try to convince her yet again to recant what she was saying, William Hutchinson said to these men of Boston, "My wife is a dear saint and servant of God." And this is after enduring tremendous hardship to maintain their life with all these children and all these dislocations. So he's really quite extraordinary.
From what you know of her, do you think it would have been possible for her to do what she did without that kind of emotional support at home?
No, I don't think it's possible. I also looked very closely at her children and what they did afterwards, because you might imagine if you have a fierce mother like this who's standing up to the ministers and the governor and all the leaders and getting banished, and perhaps not being terribly available to you because she's so busy interpreting scripture for all these people, whether they would all rebel or some of them. And they all remained loyal. Some of the sons went back to Boston and tried to get excommunicated from the church there as well. Most of her children remained on Rhode Island in the area that she founded. And they all continued to speak out in a way that would have was completely consistent with her views.
And in fact, when she went to Rhode Island, how many other people went with her?
She went with a group of about 50. They walked through the snow in early April, 1638.
We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. We've been speaking with Eve LaPlante, author of American Jezebel, The Uncommon Life of Anne Hutchinson, The Woman Who Defied the Puritans. Connection listeners, would the American Jezebel be remembered as a patriot if she had been Andrew instead of Anne? Would she be a security threat today? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and this is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. This hour we're talking about Anne Hutchinson, a woman so threatening to early American hierarchy that Harvard College was founded to insure against her kind of upstart ideas. My guest is Eve LaPlante, journalist and author of American Jezebel. And we put the question to you, how many women can you name who shaped the course of very early American history? And when politicians today talk about returning to American values, are they values you want to embrace? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts now. We want to hear from Tom. Hello, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I too had an ancestor who was persecuted by the Puritans. And I've done some genealogical research, and I found that, not only Rhode Island, but New Hampshire and New Jersey and Pennsylvania and several other colonies were founded by dissenters of the Puritan theocratic rule, and I think that the reason why Anne Hutchinson and others are left out of the history books is that the religious right in this country has sought to whitewash the Puritan image, because this was not a free society in any way. It was a theocracy, and there were many, many dissenters, and people were very upset with the Puritans. And there was Mary Dyer, the Quaker, who was hanged in the Boston Common, a friend of Anne Hutchinson, for preaching Quakerism, a rival Christian sect.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because really what Anne Hutchinson stood for was that there could be a multiplicity of voices and that there is not one right voice, which I think most Americans value today, that freedom to say what you believe. And it's ironic that she is the cause of the founding of Harvard College, which was founded to make sure somebody like her didn't rise up again. And as Reverend Gomes of Harvard has pointed out, Anne Hutchinson would probably feel extremely comfortable today, perhaps more comfortable than John Winthrop and the others who removed her.
Tom, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, what about the separation of church and state? We have that guarantee today precisely because of these excesses of the Puritans, not only Anne Hutchinson and Mary Dyer, but the Salem witch trials, et cetera, and because dissenters moved to other colonies and founded governments that said, freedom of thought, we're not going to have a state religion.
Thanks for the call, Tom. It is an interesting point, isn't it, that without these very stark examples, perhaps that barrier would not have been put up. What do you think?
I think, and when you, it's somewhat humbling to see how many people had to lose their lives in this fight for freedom of conscience and individual liberty.
I want to get on to one of the other points about her personal life, because, as you mentioned, during these trials, she was pregnant for the 16th time, but there was not a baby that resulted from that pregnancy. What happened?
What happened was, during these trials, she was pregnant at age 46 for the 16th time, and she was not feeling well. It appears from what men were describing in their journals who watched her that she was pale and wan, and she was able then to walk to Rhode Island, which took 6 days. But in Rhode Island, delivered what, it's not an infant, it was simply a mass of tissue. It's called a hydatidiform mole, and nowadays when women have these in early pregnancy, they're removed. But she carried this abnormal pregnancy to term and then delivered it and almost died from bleeding. It was this pregnancy, like Mary Dyer's abnormal pregnancy a few months earlier, was used as evidence by the ministers and leaders of Massachusetts of her alliance with Satan, and an example of how her sin had been expressed in the world in this physical form, which was standard among Puritans at the time, to see, it's the covenant of works, to see something bad that happens to you. If a child dies, somehow that would be representative of your internal sin, which most people don't believe nowadays.
And was it John Winthrop who wrote about that?
It was. In his journal, he described, he and many of the ministers focused in great detail on these abnormal pregnancies, and they even exhumed the abnormal infant born to Mary Dyer 6 months after it was buried to study it and write at great length. John Winthrop wrote of Anne Hutchinson's pregnancy, "These things which she delivered are so strange that I am almost loath to be the reporter of them, lest I should seem to feign. But see how the wisdom of God fitted this judgment to her sin every way. For look, as she had vented misshapen opinions in Massachusetts, so she must bring forth deformed monsters. And as there were about 30 opinions in number, so many monsters. And as these were public and not in a corner, so this is now come to be known and famous all over these churches and a great part of the world."
So clearly his position was, God's punishment. We were right all along about this woman.
Absolutely. And John Cotton, her former mentor, preached a text at his next Thursday lecture saying that Mistress Hutchinson's unnatural birth might signify her error in denying inherent righteousness. So again, it became a religious text as well.
Let's go back to our phone lines now. We want to hear from Rosemary, who's on the line from Amherst, New Hampshire. Hello, Rosemary.
Oh, hi. Good morning, and thank you, Gail, for the program. I just turned in on the program, and I heard Anne Hutchinson's name. I'm 73, and I went to a public school in New York City. They claim Anne Hutchinson there as well, and I'll tell you how. There is in the public school that I attended, in the auditorium, there was this huge mural painted on top of, over the soffit of the stage, and it was Anne Hutchinson in the circle with a group of Indians teaching the Indians. And she, all those days, every Friday morning, I would see her, and she was my first woman role model.
That's great, Rosemary. I think a lot of people feel that about Anne Hutchinson. What I tried to do in this book, American Jezebel, was to get back to the documents and to the places where she lived and try to flesh out the story so we might know a little more about what her daily life was like, what her family life was like, and what her actual ideas were. I think she's been a vague inspiration to many of us. I hope you'll read the book, and I'm very interested to hear your story.
And may I just say that I do intend to read it. I tried to get information about Anne Hutchinson as a young person in my, growing up. There were not more than two or three paragraphs that I could ever read about her. So this is quite enlightening for me. I do know also that Quakers have claimed her as part of their sect. And
many of her ideas presaged Quakerism. She died just before Quakerism started in England, but her good friend Mary Dyer went back to England, became Quaker, and then came to Massachusetts to try to bring Quakerism here. So there is a very strong link.
Let's go to another phone call now. Thanks, Rosemary. We want to go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and hear from David, who has an interesting question about Anne Hutchinson. Hi, David.
Hi there. I was just wondering if you'd ever heard of the relationship between Anne Hutchinson and Hester Prynne in Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, also John Cotton as Arthur Dimmesdale.
Yes, I have, and I describe that in American Jezebel. Anne Hutchinson was one of Hawthorne's inspirations for Hester Prynne and The Scarlet Letter, and most interestingly, the elusive Reverend John Cotton is apparently a model for Arthur Dimmesdale, which I think is fascinating.
David, thanks for the call. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Speaking of which, I have to ask you, do you bristle a little bit about that fictionalized portrait as Hester Prynne? Because in The Scarlet Letter, I mean, this was a woman who committed adultery and had an illegitimate child. Clearly, that is not what Anne Hutchinson did.
No, although the men of Boston accused her of it, and at one point in her church trial, the minister, John Wilson, said to her, her minister with whom she had had battles in church and outside, said to her, well, you have committed adultery. And she said, I would never do such a thing, because she was really quite a very solid conventional Puritan. And he said, well, you may. And, I mean, of course, we all may do things, but, that was a bad thing to say. But I don't really bristle when Hawthorne takes a great character like Anne Hutchinson and uses her. I think it's fascinating to see how these various figures, early figures, have been used in American literature. I mean, it's intriguing that he chooses to make the Anne Hutchinson figure and the Reverend figure sexual partners, because there is absolutely no evidence for that, and perhaps that makes the story more palatable to the American audience. But I think it's interesting, and Carol Gilligan, the feminist scholar, is doing work now on The Scarlet Letter and trying to connect it back to Anne Hutchinson. So I guess I wouldn't bristle. I just would observe it and try to understand what it means about the way we think.
Well, it sort of points you towards something interesting, that Hester Prynne is so much better known than Anne Hutchinson, doesn't it?
It's true. I hope that will change.
By the time you finished writing, how well did you feel you knew her? And after living in this world of your imagination for so long, I have to imagine that it was a little strange to look around. Here you are living in the Boston area, and there's Charlestown, and there's, all of these little touchstones of her life that are not so far away from where you live every day of your life.
Yes, and I had the privilege of going to all the places she lived, including Alford and Lincolnshire and London, and seeing where her father's church was on the bank of the Thames, and all the places she lived in the Bronx and Rhode Island. I felt I knew her as well as I could, and quite deeply, but it's always frustrating, the limitations on the documents, and that's why I went to the places, because all we have is the trial transcript.
And nothing in her words.
Nothing. Well, it's a lot of her
written
words.
By her.
Nothing she wrote. We don't have letters from women of the 17th century, and we have their birth records, their marriage records, and their death. In her case, we don't have her death, but we know when she died because it was a noted event in New York. I felt I knew her as well as I could, and I felt a tremendous sense of identification that many of her concerns, worries, and convictions were issues that women today face. And I felt no more of the shame that I had felt as a child, or the vague sense there was something awry here. I felt great pride in this woman who had stood up to so many obstacles and shown such courage.
And there is also such irony in how she died.
There is. I don't like to exactly give away the end of the story, but she was killed as a result of a battle between the Dutch and the Indians in New York. She had left the English territory because she was still being pestered by the Massachusetts authorities, even in Rhode Island. And she moved with her six younger children after her husband died to the Bronx near the Split Rock in Pelham Bay, and refused to arm herself against the Indians who were battling with the Dutch, and as a result was killed, massacred by Indians who were coming through in their battle to kill the Dutch. When the Indians discovered that she was not Dutch and in fact a noted English woman, the chief renamed himself after Anne Hutchinson and adopted the one surviving daughter who had hid in the Split Rock during the massacre. And she then basically lived with the Indians for 6 or 7 years, learned their language to John Winthrop's dismay, and then at 18 came back to Boston and married an Englishman, moved to Rhode Island, and raised a large family. So it is a fascinating story.
If she were alive today, who do you think she'd be? What would she be doing?
Well, I think she would have to be a minister. I think that with the current separation of church and state, she would not wield the political power that she did by necessity in early Boston, which I think was inadvertent on her part. I think she would be a very charismatic preacher of some sort or inspirational figure in the modern world.
In a religious context or in some other context?
Well, Anne Hutchinson, I think that particular woman would be in a religious context.
Because that was so much of who she was.
Yeah, it was so much of her, and indeed the Bible played such a big role in the lives of all these people in early Massachusetts. It was astonishing to me. That was their one text. If children learned to read, they learned to read the Bible.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a fascinating hour.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Gail.
Eve LaPlante is the author of Seized and of American Jezebel, The Uncommon Life of Anne Hutchinson, the Woman Who Defied the Puritans. You can continue the conversation in our online forums at theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Catherine Fidelrosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection from NPR.